Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to be talking about endocrinology, and you'll find out what that is in a minute. And our guest today is Bert W. O'Malley. He's the chair, actually, of the Molecular and Cell Biology Department at Baylor College of Medicine, well-recognized throughout the world for his studies on endocrinology. And some people have likened his name, O'Malley, with the Baylor College of Medicine to that of DeBakey with the other facilities in Houston way back in transplant days. So, Bert O'Malley, welcome to Science Studio.
Thanks. Glad to be on with you, Keith.
So let's start out a little bit about you and your background. How did you decide that science, medicine, research was an interesting career for you right from the early go?
I grew up in a rather poor section of Pittsburgh called Garfield and in a mainly Irish neighborhood. And very few people went to school or anything there. But my mother, I guess, had a vision and always pushed me a little bit on it that I would someday be a physician. And, of course, my dad was encouraging this. And I, sort of fooled around in school for a while. And I got to high school, the Catholic high school, Central Catholic in Pittsburgh, and really got down to business studying. And I got into medical school at Pitt. I had some scholarships to other out-of-city and state schools, but our finances made me stay at home. So I went to University of Pittsburgh undergraduate, and then on into medical school there. And at that time, it was a growing school.
So it was your mother, really, suggested perhaps she had the vision of you being Dr. O'Malley.
That's right. She did. And she was cognizant that I was going to do what I wanted, but that was her vision of me. And, you know, I was interested in various medical things early in the game and was intent on going to medical school since probably about the sixth, seventh grade. And at Pitt, I got married after my freshman year, and I needed a job. And so I got a job. I did well in biochemistry there. So I got a job in the biochemistry department working for a steroid metabolism scientist, Seymour Koretz. And I worked during the summers and during the school year for 2.5 years. So I got pretty proficient in the lab, but I had no interest in going into research at the time. I was still thinking of a clinical. In fact, when I went to medical school, I thought I would be a psychiatrist. And then I sort of found out what they do, and I decided that wasn't going to be me.
Which was the part that you didn't like about what they did?
All this Freudian stuff, you know, the Oedipus complex and things. I just couldn't buy that kind of stuff. So I thought, you know, this has got to be more chemical than that going on in the brain. Then in my senior year, I did an elective for 9 months with the head of endocrinology there, James Field, and he let me do my own project, which I worked on, how thyroid hormone actually worked. And this was a totally different ballgame, because now I had something of my own. I wasn't working on protocols for somebody else in the lab. I was doing some of my own experiments. I ended up writing a paper on it, and I got hooked. And I decided then I would go to Duke for some endocrinology residency and general medicine residency, and then I would go to NIH, which I did.
Well, before we get into the journey that you took, let's talk a little bit to the audience and to myself. Define for us what is endocrinology.
Okay. Endocrinology is basically the study of the function and mechanism of action of hormones. And there are the traditional hormones everybody knows, like estrogen and progesterone and growth hormone and thyroid hormone and vitamin D and, you know, androgens and things like this. But there are another 1,000 or so hormones in the body. And we inherit our capacity in our genes, but they must be turned on and off. They must function correctly. So it's all about regulation, the genes. When they're on, when they're off, how much they're on, how much they're off.
And that's what the hormones do.
That's the hormones control the genes, yes, and the gene function and the cell function. So they will cause the cells to spring into action. And I thought this was a fascinating field. We didn't know very much about how they worked at all in those days. It was just working about, most people working on just how they're made and some of the common ones. So the field has exploded in since time. And so just working on the steroid hormones I work on, which is androgens, estrogen, glucocorticoids, and things like that, you know, there's well over 100,000 scientists in around the world, clinical and basic, working in that field.
That's pretty nice. But tell us, I mean, most of us know hormones that if we've got something that's not quite right in our functioning, we say, oh, it just must be hormones. And so that's about as far as most of us ever get to think about hormones. So they are produced where?
Well, The hormones traditionally were thought to be made in one organ, travel in the bloodstream to go act in other organs. For instance, like the adrenal, it makes cortisol, the cord hormone, which goes and acts through the blood and into other tissues, create functions for metabolism. But now we know since then that hormones can be made locally in the tissue and act in the same tissue. And in fact, they can be made in a cell and act back in the same cell they're made. So basically, there's many more hormones than we thought before. They basically control all the functions of a cell from a regulatory point of view.
So, I mean, that's like a sort of a feedback mechanism that a cell knows that it's lacking something and produces the hormone to activate a particular process.
Exactly.
Which is quite extremely sophisticated.
Well, the human body is the most amazing thing I've ever considered or even thought of. And I think that's only one more example of how fine the control is in the evolution of a human being.
Yeah, and the other thing that's sort of on that scale to me anyway is the universe, which seems to be getting bigger and bigger, and possibility of multiple universes. It's beyond my imagination, actually, I must say. But anyway, going back then to this business of the hormones, when was the first hormone sort of recognized in scientific terms? When did people first say, there are these molecules, these species? And when was the first one characterized and structurally understood?
Well, some of the early work was done at the late 1800s and turn of the century. We really saw the early experiments in the field where somebody knew that one organ caused an effect on the body and it affected tissues elsewhere. But they didn't know exactly how this occurs, but considered the fact that that organ, such as the adrenal or the testicle or the ovary or something, was making something that somehow got out of that tissue and circulated. And people started trying to chemically isolate these kind of hormones, and they did that. And some of the first ones were androgens isolated from the testicle and shown to affect tissue growth and maybe prostate size in animals when given to animals.
And was that work on Europe, obviously, I presume, or no?
Yeah, that work was in Europe. There was work starting in U.S. at that time, too, but it was pretty unsophisticated at that time. It was pretty gross, and people didn't have any idea of the precision of the hormone and endocrine system.
So when you finally did your residency at Duke and you had your own little project, take us back into that particular project. How did you go about solving the issue that you thought you were tackling?
Okay, well, since I worked in a laboratory that, for my job, not the research I did with Jim Field, but my job during medical school, I was working on how hormones, in fact, specifically steroid hormones, were made, things like cortisol, How was this made by tissue cells? And I was not so interested in that, but my interest was, after they're made, how do they work in a cell? They seem to have great effects on organs. So when I went to NIH, I decided I would work on how hormones work, and specifically the steroid hormones. And I particularly was interested in estrogen and progesterone, the female hormones.
So let me back into that. Were you also, you say you were interested in how they were constructed, how they were made. Did you actually get into any synthesis?
Yes, we used to synthesize them in explant and tissue constructs of adrenal in the laboratory that came from mice.
Okay. And I just want to emphasize to the listeners that here you are in medical school and had a job. That's not what most people think about when they go to medical school. Medical school seems to be a very tough, throw as much information at the student as you can and make as much stick for as short a period of time. No time for jobs, no time for too much relaxation.
Well, you can say that again, because I not only worked after school in the labs and on Saturdays, but three nights a week I worked in the hospital taking some physicals from patients and so forth, again for money. But I was married now and having two kids, and so we had to, to a large degree, support ourselves. So it was basically for money at that time. But I got good at it, and then eventually my brain started to say, hey, this might be a good job. Maybe you want to do more of this and see maybe a little less patients. But I decided I would be doing both rather than giving up clinical medicine at the time, early times.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell, and I'm talking today with Bert O'Malley, who's a professor and chair, actually, of molecular and cell biology at the Baylor College of Medicine and a world authority on endocrinology, and now you know what that means. We'll be back in one moment. Welcome back to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Bert O'Malley from the Baylor College of Medicine, talking about a career that has sort of encompassed so much interesting new work, but it started from him having a job in medical school, and I don't think too many people go to medical school now have time for a job, maybe.
Well,
maybe they should. I mean, talk about that, Bert. Do you think medical school is just too much bookwork nowadays?
Well, it was always too much bookwork.
Right.
But, you know, you do what you have to do. And when you're in medical school, you have a family, you have to learn, and you have to work. You can do what you need to do. You just get a lot less sleep, and you have to be very efficient in your time. And I still graduated first in my class at medical school, so I wasn't goofing around in there, you know.
Well, it's all very interesting, because I had children very early in my career, and it was a great help to get out of graduate school fast. I will say that.
Yeah.
Right? Luckily, in graduate school, we didn't have ranking, so I could have been bottom of my graduating class, but there wasn't a graduating class in PhDs anyway. So let's go back then to this business of your studies. And I remember I just recently was lucky enough to hear you give a talk. And one of the things that you talked about was the fact, yes, indeed, people like to think of their genetic background and say, ah, I've got good genes, I've got a good genetic pedigree. And you warned the audience, hey, don't get too proud of your genes, because why don't you explain what I'm talking about to the audience?
Well, you know, capacity and function of genes are two separate things. So you inherit half your genes, combination of half from both parents, okay? And this sets your capacity. You inherit what the genes could do. But the genes are inert without the signals that turn them on and off, of which the main signals are hormones and the endocrine system. So it's all about the genes functioning. And for the genes function, you must activate them or repress them or turn them off. And this is a very subtle and beautiful regulatory system that's involved in mammals and in humans in particular. And it allows us to bring the function out of our genes. Whereas, you know, it's like, you've seen people that you say, boy, that person has had great capacity and they're wasting their life. Well, you would be wasting your genes if you didn't have the hormone and endocrine system to turn them on and off when you need the products of those genes, which are eventually RNA and proteins and metabolic changes.
So then what is it that causes two identical, let's say identical twins? Are there any clear cases where they both have the same capacity, but the actual turning on and turning off is different? And what controls that turning on and turning off?
Yes. Well, you know, in identical twins, of course, they come from the same sperm and egg, and therefore, you know, the genes themselves are very similar, maybe a few small little changes that are almost insignificant. But the regulation of those genes is somewhat different, and that to some degree is determined by the environment. So your environment, how you manage nutrition for yourself, maybe what type of environmental toxins you're exposed to, stress, even temperature changes or work efforts or things like this can modify the endocrine system so you release a little more or less hormone. So that you ended up having slightly different functions than even though you have the same genes. Now, your body tends to be similar with the identical twins. So it's any changes between identical twins, which there are some, of course, always, even though they may look the same. The twins have a certain different maybe preferences, slightly different mental capacities and function in their everyday life. That's due to environmental impact on the endocrine system.
So we're back to that old nature versus nurture.
That's right.
Exactly the same discussion.
That's right.
And so your particular interest, let's say where you are today, you've had having a great career. What are the questions that you're asking yourself today, and what's the relevance to that question to the bigger field?
Well, my great desire is to understand the mysteries of nature. So really, the driving force behind me is to understand how hormones work. And believe me, it is a tough job to get all the details, and we're constantly finding new things. When I started in this work on how, say, just steroid hormones, estrogen, progesterone work, I thought, well, I'll do this for 5 years, settle this, then I'll start working on some protein hormones, like growth factors or something. And, well, here I am, still on the same quest after 40-some years, and keeps me every day excited about work. And as we've come later now and we've found out a lot about how hormones work, my particular current desire is to know how do we regulate these, and specifically their function in diseases, diseases such as cancer, primary interest, also obesity, metabolism, diabetes, and so forth. So we are currently also developing drugs. Once we find out the little molecules involved in carrying out the message of a hormone to the gene and turning the gene on, we can now attack those little molecules with new kinds of therapy as we develop drug against those little molecules.
Yeah, well, let's talk about those little molecules. I mean, these would be sort of activators of some description?
Exactly. Yeah. So when a hormone, just to try to keep it relatively simple, comes into a cell, there's a little protein it binds to that calls a receptor. The hormone sends that little receptor protein to the genes, to the DNA, the genes, and it picks out the genes to be turned on or off by that hormone. But for the genes to actually be turned on or off, they must recruit another group of proteins called coactivators. We didn't know about those for most of my career, but we found the first ones about 13 years ago and been publishing and understanding how they work for many years, and that opened up a whole new world in there. So because these are the final molecular effectors of gene function, then if you could regulate those, you could regulate very precisely at the endpoint gene function. And so we developed drugs against these coactivators, which have so far great promise in cancer. And we have some early companies started to work with these drugs that we've discovered too and synthesized.
So what you're saying is that you can intercept the coactivator if you need to intercept it, if that's causing a problem, if it's causing a disease.
That's right. For instance, some of the group of coactivators that control the growth genes in a cell are used extensively by cancer cells. So cancer cells overproduce these type of molecules because these molecules then help the cancer cell turn on at maximum rate all the growth genes in the cell. And this is a very advantageous for the cancer cell, which wants relentless growth. So we've got drugs that bind to those particular growth coactivators and turn them off. And therefore, they turn off the cancer cell's growth, and in fact, they end up killing the cancer cell, but not normal cells.
Which, of course, is the secret to the whole business of cancer treatment.
Yes.
There are a lot of things that kill cancer cells, but they don't leave the rest of the cells alone.
Oh, that's a toughie. Cancer cells are amazingly difficult to work with.
Let's talk a little bit about then the specific diseases. You say you're working with different companies. Do you have one particular disease where you can say that the science that you've been doing and the technology that's out there is having a major impact yet?
Yes, we have, well, people yet. This has been relatively recent, like in the last 3 years. So we just have a lot of data on cells and animals at the present time. So we're not into people with these yet. But the drugs look very promising. And the drugs we have, which have just a little chemical name, we call, just put letters on them, like SI2 or SI12 or something. Then this molecule will regulate the coactivators in cancers, and they will shut down the growth of cancers such as breast, prostate, and lung, and pancreas. So we're pretty excited about these because they...
Hang on a minute. You're talking about the same molecular structure molecule that is doing this for all these different types of cancer?
That's exactly right, because the common thing for the cancer is they all require relentless growth to replicate and divide constantly. So growth is really the final goal of a cancer cell. It just wants to reproduce over and over and over and over. So eventually it eats up the local tissue, it eats up the nutrition of the body, the chemicals of the body, and produces a lot of toxic byproducts. So basically it's eating you alive as you have it. It's not the, you know, the primary tumor. You get a small tumor growing somewhere often, not always, because you don't get it in time. You can cut it out surgically. But cells have gotten out of that primary cancer lesion, and they've gotten into other tissues already. When they start growing again, it's the metastasis around the body that go to other organs or the brain or various places where they eventually will kill you. So that's what you want to really attack. And the drugs we have are very effective in killing the metastatic cells, the metastasis.
But the interesting thing from what I've just learned is that I've always had the illusion that all different cancers needed different treatments. But what you're saying here is, in a sense, because of this growth feature, that in fact there may be, well, I'll say the word, you can correct it as soon as I said it, a silver bullet that can go after any form of cancer.
Well, that's what we hoped would be the advantage of these. See, if you have a pathway or a chain of events in a cell, it causes an endpoint of function. If you inhibit the chain up at the beginning, then that's where the cancers are all different. So therefore, you need to have therapies that are more specific for individual cancers. But sooner or later, they all get down to the genome, the genes, and they need the growth factors, the growth genes turned on, or they won't grow. And if they won't grow, the cancer cell will die.
What animals do you use? This is rats and mice, or?
Yeah, we use, of course, in culture, we use animal cells and human cells.
Right.
And we then use mice. And we also can use what we call a PDX animal. I won't go into how that's made. But you can actually, you take cancer tissue from a human, and you can place that into a type of a mouse that has a compromised immune system, and it'll grow. So you can actually be treating the human tissue cancer in a mouse too, besides treating mouse tumors themselves.
So what's the next stage then? When do you say, well, we now would like, of course, to treat people? Does one have to get volunteers of people in the very sort of last stages, if I could put it that way, of cancer to volunteer? Or is it much more complex?
Well, what we have to do just in front of us right now, we know this is a new class of drugs that has never been developed before. So that's interesting in itself as a first, so-called first in class. So we know these work on cancer cells in culture and cancers in animals. So the next thing we have to do is we have to pick out one of the chemical forms of these molecules and decide that this is our lead compound. Then we have to do a lot of toxicity studies on it. It has to be given to a lot of different animals and perhaps even monkeys or something. And we have to make sure it has no toxic consequences. Now, in the mice or rats, it's not having any toxic consequences at the dose that kills the tumor. But as you move to people, you never know. So you will try different species of animals to look at toxicity. And if we find no toxicity, then we can have approval to try some early studies in humans. And the initial humans would be volunteers with cancer, but they would agree to take very small doses of this at the time that seemed to be clearly non-toxic. And then you start increasing the dose in them, and you watch for any toxic effects or damaging effects in the human that are in the human tissue as the cancer is affected.
What about primates? Does one ever use primates for this, and they would be better models perhaps than mice and rats?
They are better models. Problem is, they're very hard to get many of these. They're very expensive, and the facilities to treat these are few and far between.
Is that an ethical reason for that? I mean,
yes. It's basically ethics. And the people feel that the monkeys are too close to humans and we shouldn't be experimenting on them. Now, people are very divided on this. If we don't, first of all, some people think we shouldn't do experiments in animals at all. Well, we would have many, many people dead in this world more if we weren't allowed to try things out in animals first. It's the only way you can develop a drug for humans. And you have to say, what is our goal here? Our primary goal is humans. So we have a lot of rules about the animals, too. You can't make them sick. You have to do the surgery in very special ways, sterile things, and you have to exercise the animals and all this stuff. So we take very good care of them.
Hey, Bert, we've just got a couple of minutes, and I just want to get to one feature here. Nowadays, a lot of pressure on universities to turn out students who will go on for an MD, PhD, as opposed to a PhD or an MD. And you're a world-class researcher. You only have an MD, only. and you worked very hard to get it. Do you have any thoughts about that for our students that are listening? The validity of spending those extra years to do an MD, PhD, as opposed to, you know, just the MD and get into research like yourself?
Okay. So, first of all, people have to think more about the future, what they might want to be trained for. Now, if you know you're going to be a physician to care for people and have nothing to do with research, then it's a very easy choice to be an MD.
Yes.
There are a lot of people think, well, I'll get an MD, and then I'll also be partially trained or wholly trained for research, too. That's not the case. In fact, nowadays, you get no research training as you become an MD. So you have to go get that afterwards, and you have to accumulate the years of training for the research, which essentially is getting a PhD. So one organized way to do is to get an MD PhD together, where you get both the clinical training and the research training. When you come out, you have your card in both fields.
And do you, just to sum up, because we have no more time, but you think this is a career goal that is totally appropriate and you're encouraged by what you see?
Oh, yes, yes. I think we need more young people in science. It's the most wonderful job in the world.
And as long as we keep getting the funding for it, that's another feature altogether.
Yes.
But hey, Bert O'Malley, the people out there listening don't know I'm recording this. We are recording this on St. Patrick's Day, and I know that you did become an Irish citizen, not because you were born
yes.
there.
Yes, I am an Irish citizen, also, of course, a U.S. citizen initially.
Right.
I like to think of the old country, too, and I visit there, and I have affinity for that.
Do you play golf?
I have played some in younger years. Right now, I'm mostly just working.
Okay. Bert O'Malley, Baylor College of Medicine, endocrinologist, phenomenal record of research and recognition. And I didn't even go into all the awards you've won. But thank you so much for being here on Science Studio.
Keith, I enjoyed it. Thank you, and thanks to the audience.
Thank you out there, and thank you, Kimberly Garcia, for putting the program together. Bye-bye.